The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's The Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, we're going to be taking an in-depth look at the latest on health and healing, the use of antibiotics in our food supply. Also, we're going to examine Europe sowing the seeds of hunger, what they're doing wrong with their farming over there, Jim Hightower on privatization, the road to hell, and also about the House passing authorized Worldwide War Act, meaning we can build a war machine and put it in place anywhere we want based on this new authorization. So we're going to talk about that. My guest in the second part of our program, Dr. Mark Weisbrot, is going to talk about Portugal, Ireland, Greece, and Spain and the failure of austerity measures. And are we facing the same in the United States? I believe we are. And I'll also tell you about the worst cities, the most dangerous cities in America to live in. Many of the people in this audience live there and are trying to adapt to that. I wouldn't recommend that. And I'll explain why when I give you the most dangerous places in America to live and therefore why it wouldn't be the best idea in the long term to stay there. There is time for prudent, practical, reasonable preparation to move to places that are safer, nicer, more sustainable. So as you see, we have a full show. I will open our lines when I get to our commentary section. So let us begin. In one of the books, the very first bestsellers I ever wrote, it was called Body Pollution. I talked about how at that time, 1974, the Food and Drug Administration and the U.S. Department of Agriculture were allowing very high amounts of human antibiotics to be used in animal food. Now the question is, why would we be using that? It wasn't because the animals were kept in feedlots, which are extremely unhealthy. You can smell a feedlot about 20 miles before you actually see it if you're downwind, because you'll have where it's normal to have two animals per acre minimum. I actually prefer two animals per every 5 acres for grazing, because when animals graze, they just graze and they eliminate, graze and eliminate. What's good for the soil? Not good because of bacteria. Now imagine 5,000 animals in 5 acres or 1,000 animals per acre. They are packed in there. These are the feedlots where 24 hours a day, mechanized conveyor belts put food into troughs, and the animals just eat. They're given tranquilizers to keep them calm. They're given massive amounts of antibiotics because it allows them to get fat faster. That was the real reason they were given it. And, of course, the bacteria is just overwhelming because they can't clean up the mess, because the mess is right in the middle of all the animals. So just imagine 2 feet of cow manure that they're living in. That's the animals that you're eating, and not people in this audience, but those who eat them. Now, I told this story. I wrote about it. I went on a national tour to debate the importance of cleaning up factory farms and switching to a vegetarian diet. At that time, there was a very receptive audience. I had one audience out in Phoenix. Thousands of people showed up. There's a photograph of that up on my website, an old picture. Today, I would not get as many people showing up to talk about vegetarianism, but at that time, it was a unique step forward. In fact, I used to get, I'm going to suggest, 4,000 or 5,000 or 6,000 people per lecture. Wherever I lectured, it would sell out. Why? Because these were all new concepts of going green and having more raw foods and the consequences of juicing in your diet. Things that we take for granted today, But that's when a lot of people, especially younger people, were getting into it. Then we got complacent. Then we started shopping in stores like Whole Foods, which are really trendy shopper stores. There's a lot of food I would never recommend anyone eating in there. In fact, the largest departments many of those Whole Foods are alcohol and meat. And then a lot of just refined carbohydrate food. But it's a business, this multinational corporation. And they set their own standards. And people then who don't really want to be purist or don't want to make the difficult choices of really cleaning up the diet, which is not that difficult, tend to go there because they feel, well, I'm shopping at Whole Foods. I must be doing something right. No, you're not. Because for every one of those gigantic 40 or 60,000 square foot Whole Foods come in, all the small little high-level integrity stores that have been serving you are pushed out of business. In any case, back to the issue. So now comes an article from Medical News Today. Quote, antibiotics in animal feed encourages emergence of superbugs. FDA sued by health and consumer organizations. Let me quote this because I think this is very relevant, even though it's 34 years late. Quote, if the FDA concluded in 1977 that adding low-dose antibiotics used in human medicine to animal feed raised the risk of antibiotic-resistant bacteria, that's what I wrote about, by the way, why has it still done nothing about it? A suit filed by some health and consumer organizations says the FDA has not met its legal responsibility to protect public health. The practice of routinely adding low-dose antibiotics to animal feed has to stop, and the FDA has the authority to make it so. Now, this is from Peter Lerner, National Resource Defense Council, Executive Director. Quote, more than a generation has passed since FDA first recognized the potential human health consequences of feeding large quantities of antibiotics to healthy animals. Accumulating evidence shows that antibiotics are becoming less effective while our grocery store meat is increasingly laden with drug-resistant bacteria. The FDA needs to put the American people first by ensuring that antibiotics continue to serve their primary purpose, saving human lives by combating disease. By the way, 70% of all U.S. antibiotic consumption is used up in adding low doses to animal feed to make up for unsanitary living conditions and promote faster growth, according to the National Natural Resource Defense Council. The antibiotic doses used in feed or water for turkeys, cows, pigs, and chickens and are too low to treat diseases. However, they are low enough for a significant number of bacteria to survive and build up resistance. And these antibiotics, like penicillin and tetracyclines, are used to treat humans. And hence, when you do need an antibiotic to save your life, and you have a little bug, well, that bug may have developed resistance because of all the antibiotics that have been used. Then your antibiotic doesn't work, and then you die. So the Center for Science of Public Interest, Michael Jacobson's group, Food Animal Concern Trust, Public Citizen, Union of Concerned Scientists, and the Natural Resource Defense Council all sued the FDA. It's long overdue. Glad they did it. And now let's hope they win. Next up, more U.S. women using medicines during pregnancy. I'll quote this from Reuters. It says, most pregnant women in the United States use at least one prescription or over-the-counter medication, even though the safety of those drugs during pregnancy is not always clear. That's according to a new study. And by the way, an awful lot of women are using antibiotics. They're using, by the way, those yeast infections and urinary tract infections could be treated naturally. We know all about how to get rid of urinary tract infections with high levels of alpha lipoic acid and vitamin C and cranberry concentrate, pomegranate concentrate, lemon juice. We don't need antibiotics. Also the tranquilizers. If a woman is pregnant and feels that she is depressed enough to require therapy, then seek out the counseling of a holistic psychologist or therapist, not use drugs. Why? All those drugs, over-the-counter drugs and prescription drugs, they all find a way through the placental barrier into the developing fetus. And that increases the risk of all forms of brain defects, learning disabilities, stillbirth, and miscarriage. So you thought our young people were healthy. Wrong. They're not. This is the latest study. 1 in 5 young adults has serious high blood pressure. That's right. And that can link itself to heart attacks and strokes. This is the American Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology, based upon an examination of 30,000 individuals. So it's unfortunate, but when we look at 24 to 32-year-old young adults, 19% or approximately one-fifth have high blood pressure. Why do we have high blood pressure, which leads to coronary heart disease, heart failure, stroke, kidney failure? It's simple. The junk food, all of the French fries, pizzas, hamburgers, hot dogs, all of that contains high levels of sodium. So just be aware, we're putting an entire generation at risk of dying prematurely. Men, if you want to increase your reproductive health, get vitamin D. Vitamin D plays an important role in improving male reproduction, that's according to University of Copenhagen researchers. Also, how many times have we heard studies from the statin makers, the tranquilizer makers, the chemotherapy makers that were very positive, the AIDS drug makers, they're at the top of the list in this? Well, it might be because of conflict of interest. Here's the newest study from the European League Against Rheumatism. Quote, study reveals that financial conflicts of interest are associated with positive study outcomes. I'll quote this. It says, results demonstrate that 91% of randomized controlled trials recorded this kind of financial conflict of interest achieve a positive outcome compared to those that didn't have financial conflicts of interest. Now, what is a conflict of interest? Well, let's say the chief author of a study on statins says that statins are good. But they don't tell you that if you buy the drug, this man or woman makes a big profit. Or let's say that they bring in a ghostwriter to write up the results of a study, and then they give this person a research grant of $1 million. Do you think that a person who gets a research grant of $1 million is going to jeopardize that by writing up a bad report? So what we're dealing with is greed. And we're showing that greed in science is rampant, and that once you have someone who has a financial conflict of interest, the study is going to be reported as positive instead of negative. So you can't trust the studies until you find out who financed. Is there any conflict of interest? For those women who've been using estrogen or been exposed to a lot of estrogen, if you're overweight, if you're under stress, and if you eat meat, you have elevated estrogen. This is the article published in the American Journal of Physiology, Regulatory, Integrative, and Comparative Physiology. Quote, there is a link between chronic estrogen exposure and high blood pressure. And then I read the actual study, and it shows if you've been around using estrogen or like hormone replacement therapy, you're running a big risk of ending up with high blood pressure and hence a stroke. I suggest that you rebalance your hormones naturally and get into the hands of a qualified nutritionist or physician who has a background in rebalancing biochemistry. And next up, the omega-3 fatty acids, which you can also get from vegan sources, can cut the risk of artery disease and heart attacks for patients with stents. This is published in the peer-reviewed journal Arteriosclerosis, Thrombosis, and Vascular Biology, Journal of the American Heart Association. Quote, omega-3 fatty acids combined with two blood-thinning drugs significantly change the blood clotting process and may reduce the risk of heart attack in patients with stents in their heart arteries. Well, that's good news. They used 1,000 milligrams. I would suggest double that. And this was a double-blind, placebo-controlled study. One more notch in hundreds of studies showing the importance of the omega-3 fatty acids. Now, as many of you every day wake up, I know that you're starting your day, as I do, by making yourself first exercising, which is good, and then following with a really good drink. And that drink should have your protein from high-quality branched-chain amino acids, non-genetically engineered material. I'm suggesting between 20 and 30 grams of protein, which is ideal for 90% of Americans. Then you have your essential fatty acids. You have your probiotics that recolonize good bacteria in your intestine, which can help prevent all forms of disease and help your immune system. You want high-quality fiber. I'm suggesting 15 to 20 grams just so you have a nice cleansing action of keeping your intestine and your colon and your large intestine, small intestine clean. And that removes debris, the fiber does. It acts like a gentle sponge to clean out the intestine. And then you have your phytonutrients from a wide variety of sources, both fruits and vegetables. And these go in and repair your DNA. They help to not only repair damaged DNA, but they also flood the body with antioxidants, which trap free radicals, turn off inflammation in your joints, in your arteries, in your brain, and then start the whole process of repair and rejuvenation. Filling your body with enzymes is also very powerful, too. And chlorophyll, of course, keeps the kidneys and the liver healthy, cleanses the blood, and also helps in starting the whole rejuvenation process, slowing down the rejuvenation. Now, many of you have been doing that for a long time, and you know the difference. When people get on a cleansing and detoxification rejuvenation program, and you're doing that now, if you really are wanting to maximize your health, you do that probably 3 times a day. And for people with different illnesses, there's different configurations that which can go up very high. And that's why a lot of people are alive today that otherwise would not be, and healthier who are not. So it's always nice when we see that mainstream science finds one of these solutions to what they've been looking for, and we can say, good for you. We've been doing that a long time. Here's the latest. And this is from Science Daily. So this is the heart of mainstream science, published in the peer-reviewed journal, scientific journal, Public Library of Sciences, and which is actually Public Library of Sciences 1, which also is called PLOS. Quote, a family of natural occurring plant compounds could help prevent or delay memory loss associated with Alzheimer's, according to a new study by the Translational Genomics Research Institute. Beta-carboline alkaloids could potentially be used in therapeutic drugs to stop or at least slow down the progressively debilitating effects of Alzheimer's. One of these alkaloids, called harmine, inhibits a protein known as DYRK1A, which has been implicated by this and other studies in the formation of tau phosphorylation, and that creates Alzheimer's. Okay, I won't go into the science anymore on this because I'm looking at the actual scientific study. But here's what's important. They don't actually tell you which plants with a beta carboline alkaloid harmine are important. Well, but I will. Passion flower and mescaline and caltrop, that's used in Ayurveda, also in psilocybin, psilocybin. So for those of you who've been using your powders, your green powders, your red powders, good for you. You're way ahead of the curve, and science is just starting to catch up. So when I brought Marie McGovern, a very intelligent, creative, very thoughtful and sensitive human being, on the stage with thousands of scientists in Washington, D.C., and I just asked her to share a little bit of her story to the thousands of scientists who were sitting there, And if you've never been to a scientific conference, it works this way. They go to these, A, because the doctors get continuing education credits, but also it's a place to see the latest state-of-the-art anti-aging research. Most of this is on stem cells. Most of it's about applying for grants. Most of it is university-based and or proprietary corporation-based genomic companies. And they're explaining what is possible. Rarely, if ever, however, do they actually have results. The room is generally dark. Everyone's working off their the big screen is behind you. And then if they have questions, they type in on their laptops. And then a monitor selects the questions and asks the presenter. To become a presenter at one of these, you have to have done original research in a field. You have to be acknowledged for that. You have to have information that is verifiable. It's a very hard place to get into. And I've been into it many times. In fact, I'm invited virtually every year. I can't always go. I've done, I think, six of them. And I've been invited at least a dozen times because of all the clinical trials I do on humans using lifestyle modification and the results, which are so so promising. And also, not just promising, they help people. And not just one person, a whole group of people. And because we've done some of these two or three times to show it wasn't a fluke and come up with similar results. So anyhow, I got off script. I just said, no, I'm not going to go this way. Instead, what I did was I asked the people who had been in the different clinical studies to come up and share their results. And I said, you know, I have a study in front of you. You have the study. But why not look at the actual people, real human people? And that's where she came out on the stage. She talked about what she was doing and how much progress she had made. And then two other people with other conditions that orthodox medicine has no answer for and cannot reverse also showed they completely reversed their conditions. So three out of three people I brought from three separate studies. And then we exited and we went out into the corridor and hundreds of scientists came over wanting to ask questions. It's hard for them to accept that something as simple as what you eat and what you drink and how you think can impact upon the DNA. They're looking for the drug, just like Science Daily, looking for the drug, just like they found in Argentina, a plant that can reduce pain, but they want to make it into a patented drug. Because if you just told people, hey, there's this drug, or there's this natural herb in South America that people use and it turns off pain. Well, who benefits from that? How do you profit? You don't. So they don't mention that. But there is an area of science called functional medicine. And functional medicine is using natural techniques, natural therapies, much like Ayurveda, to rebalance body chemistry. What confused them was what I call the laws of compensation, which are this. To the degree that you have any cellular imbalance, either mechanical, viral, bacterial, yeast, parasitic, traumatized, or genetic mutation, anything that has altered the normal, healthy life of a cell, giving it a normal amount of nutrients will not change it. You have to exceed the level of energy, not just with thoughts, which are powerful, what is known as pleomorphism based upon epigenetics, meaning what you think your cell actually manifests. So you have to think healing thoughts because the mind can actually help enormously with the power of the thought because the power of the thought actually changes your biochemistry. But then what you put into the body has to have an energy. And medicines don't have the energy. Meat doesn't have the energy. Sugar doesn't have the energy. Alcohol doesn't have the energy. Processed foods don't have the energy. But living foods do. And concentrations of living foods then concentrate the energy, not just the specific nutrient, but the actual energy of the cell. And it shifts the energy. And once the energy has been shifted, let's say from catabolic to anabolic, from breaking down to building up, now you're actually able to repair the DNA. And now you're able to lengthen the telomeres. And now you're able to slow down the aging of the cell. And now you're able to reoxygenate the cell, and you're able to get new enzyme systems working that facilitate biochemical changes. And all this works in perfect harmony once you realize what your specific individual compensation level should be. But once you reach that, then some amazing changes. And that's why Marie McGovern is the only person that I'm aware of in the world who had completely diagnosed, medically treated, end-stage Alzheimer's, and today is a normal 95% reversed healthy human being. Compensation. It was as if I was talking a language from a different solar system. They just couldn't get it. Scientist after scientist came up to me and said, "Now, could you explain that again? Now, what do you really mean by that? Now, but what's actually in the DNA that's being changed? And do you have any petri dishes? Can you show us a slide of a single cell?" And I'm saying, "I'm not showing you a slide of a cell. I'm showing you 100 trillion cells in a living human being." They just couldn't wrap their mind around it. In Chicago, they couldn't. In London, they couldn't. In Las Vegas, they couldn't. In Washington, they couldn't. In Orlando, they couldn't, et cetera, et cetera. So it wasn't as if this were just a group of scientists, because I've lectured for tens of thousands of scientists as a keynote presenter, frequently the keynote presenter, because of the uniqueness of this research I do. Rather interesting, because you'd never know I do any research, I've ever done a clinical study, never know I've ever presented anything, because of how the media and medicine is terrified of even acknowledging another reality. So we don't want Julian Whitaker from California to talk about how he reverses diabetes in his patients or heart disease. By the way, I just spoke with Julian Whitaker this morning. He called me while I was in transit. Unfortunately, I had just gotten off a plane. I was in a car to get to another location. He says, "Gary," he says, "I'm in a big debate, and I need some of that research." I said, "What do you need?" "Vaccines." I said, "All right, Julian, you'll get it." And within an hour, my office in New York had sent him 14 major studies, fully referenced, on why vaccines have never been proven safe or effective for a given individual, and why we have a great deal of proof that there is not only not the science to support their safety or efficacy, but the science to support their danger and lack of science of efficacy and safety. In any case, he now has information he needs to go into this major national debate he's in. Well, why wouldn't people want to hang out in some of the offices of holistic doctors, holistic chiropractors, naturopaths, homeopaths, dietitians, a holistic massage therapist who do more than just regular massage but energy rebalancing, Qigong? Because if you acknowledge that there is legitimacy, then you have to disallow the quackbusters who've been completely discredited by anybody who chooses to look, and you disallow the orthodox medical community and all of its scientific bastions to no longer have the credibility. You're saying, okay, you do your work, but don't prohibit others who are getting good results, in fact, getting better results than you're getting. So in our society, we have no democracy in medicine. We have no freedom of choice. We only have one way. So it's just amazing what happens when you're able to do things, achieve things, and present them scientifically, no secrets, no financial reward, no hidden anything, all out in the open, and they still don't get it. So that's where we're at. But at least they're catching up a little bit. But they want this plant alkaloid that could slow down Alzheimer's, quote, to be a drug. Okay, we've slowed down Alzheimer's without any drugs. We've gotten them all off all drugs using natural plant alkaloids. So my question for Science Daily is, and for Public Library of Science 1, why didn't you list the actual plants that people could have used, like I just did? And finally, stress is increasing the risk of Alzheimer's. This is from Science Daily also. This is from the University of Minho in Braga, Portugal. And it says the following, quote, protein deposits in nerve cells are a typical feature of Alzheimer's disease. The excessive alteration of the tau protein through additional phosphate groups, a process known as hyperphosphorylation, causes the protein in the cells to aggregate in clumps. As a result, nerve cells die, particularly in the hippocampus, part of the brain that plays an important role in learning and memory, as well as in the prefrontal cortex, which regulates higher cognitive function. Lay language. When you're stressed, your body secretes a hormone called cortisol. Under normal circumstances, you should only secrete that for about 60 seconds. It is known as the flight or fight response. Suddenly, it's 2 o'clock in the morning, and you hear something at the door. Instantly, your eyes increase the acuity of vision, your smell, your sense of taste, your picking up vibrations from the hair on your skin. Your musculature system now is flooded with glycogen and whatever available glucose that you can produce. In other words, you're ready to fight. That will last for about 60 seconds. And then you go through the opposite. Your energy level plunges. Now, imagine that during a day, something that you wanted, you didn't get. A phone call you expected didn't happen. A letter you were expecting didn't happen. Something that you had expected didn't happen. Now you're stressed. Now you're not being threatened. You're not under attack. But your biochemistry is acting as if it is. That's the danger of thinking any form of negative thought. The other day I made a rare exception. I called someone to tell them an intuitive insight. I never do this. It's a gift that I have that my mother gave me. It does not have any place in science. It cannot be explained or understood from any organic scientific basis or physics. In the South, we simply call it being an intuitive. Kind of imagine a psychic, clairvoyant, a medium, and a healer all in one energy. My mother had the gift. Her grandmother had the gift, but not her mother. And no other brothers or sisters on either side of my father and mother's family had it. I had the gift, and it scared me as a child. I didn't want it. In fact, for the first 18 years of my life, I did everything humanly possible to avoid it, deny it, because what if you're in my brain and you see what you see, it can scare you, because you don't just see good things, you see some bad things in people or what's going to happen to them, and I don't want to know that. I have no power over that. My mother explained that don't fear, because the time will come in your life where you understand it's a great tool, and indeed she was right. And that's one of the reasons I've spent my life giving this gift as I can, to the degree that I can, to people, and to the degree that they can benefit from it. It's made a difference, without ever charging a penny to anyone in my entire life. Which goes against everything we're taught in our society. If you have a gift, if you're able to exploit it, if you become famous for it, market it. And if you are in the hierarchy, market it to the highest bidder. In other words, whatever you can do, exploit your gifts. Well, what if you don't want to? What if you believe that everyone should have the right to whatever you can offer them, and you don't need to exploit it? Why should we commercialize or commodify something? Why not just give it? Why not just share it? What's wrong with having a spiritual awareness that allows you to share? Why should everything be based upon commercialization of your asset? Well, because everyone's doing it. Okay, well, I'm not everyone, so I'm not going to do it. That said, you learn a lot. And one of the things I see is I see what a person's up to. I have this, I'm not going to explain it to you. All I can say is anyone who has an intuitive, and many people do, who has this quality can see things happening before they do. In any case, I won't go any further into it than that. But there was one person who always seemed to be behind the eight ball. Why? The person was negative, always whining and complaining and blaming, and it was always someone else's fault for everything. And three things happen when you're around these people. More often than not, their life energy is adaptive aggressive. They're users. They play people. And they play people by learning your weaknesses or learning your needs and then accommodating that until you get so used to it and you think, gee, this is great, but you don't see the downside. You don't see what their real motive is. You don't see how they're going to play you. And most people are trusting and innocent. Most people are hoping that people in their life are there for the best reasons. Adaptive aggressives almost universally are going to screw you. I mean, they're going to really take advantage of you. And this person was one of those people. And as I knew many people would come into contact with this person, it was always the same. Everything was fine to begin with, but at the end there was always this bad story about how they got this and that and the other, and gossip, maligning, etc. In any case, what I saw was this person was always stuck with health problems. But was always trying this and that process, but it never sustained. And I called the person, I simply say, I want to share something with you. It's a gift I'm sharing, though you may not perceive it as such. Did you ever realize every time you gossip, every time you're negative, every time you look at yourself as you're the victim and everyone else is responsible, where you're the one who can do no wrong and the world is just a bad place? Did you ever realize as you're throwing those harpoons into the universe, you're also sticking one in yourself? You're anchored to every single thought you have. So if you have a jealous thought, you're anchored to jealousy. If you have an insecure thought, you're anchored to insecurity. If you want to hurt someone else, you're anchored to that pain that you inflict upon others. So on the one hand, because no one may know what you've done or said about them, you think you've gotten away with it. No one gets away with anything. Everything in this world has a silent witness. Every act, every deed, every thought. So you now look like a whale with 5 million harpoons stuck in you, and you refuse to acknowledge that you have been your own worst victim. So if you ever want to see a day when you can have joy and happiness and actually be happy for other people without manipulating and using people, without looking at every opportunity as another way that you can get ahead, when you can understand that people are there with all of their limitations, not to condemn them and not to gossip about them, but rather to try to be friendly and supportive, then you're just going to live your karma in your life but never appreciate it. End of story. And this person didn't take that very well. There was just a seething sarcasm. Fine, that's what this person's been, and they'll continue that way. The larger message is this. When you create any emotion, you become the emotion you create. Now you've made a cell. You've made a neuron tape, and it's there. And you're going to keep going back to it. And you're going to repeat that pattern of behavior over and over again. But every time you think the thought, every time you repeat the pattern, you become once again what you've created. Now the question is, you've done nothing but all this creating a negativity, or the world's a terrible place, or everyone's out to get me, or this person used me and that person abused me, and I'm a victim. Get over yourself. You're not a victim. Most people are a victim of themselves. Their selfishness, their conceit, their manipulative nature, the low end of their life energy, whichever energy that may be, and using people as pawns. That's the reality of how more often than not we become victims and are choosing not to know the truth of our actions and then hoping that it works out all right. Almost always when you do not choose to know the truth will smack you down. I made a statement a few years ago, and I did a lecture on it. Learn your lessons openly, or the universe will learn the lesson and give it to you. And you're not going to like it. So that's one of the ways that we can get out of stress, chronic stress, and hence chronic high blood pressure and chronic heart disease and overeating and being angry but not knowing what to do with our anger. And then it ends up leading to all forms of disease and dysfunction, and destroys relationships without being aware that every time we throw energy out, we're throwing it in. I'm Gary Noll, back in a moment with our guest. I don't have time now for our commentary, but our guest is coming right at us in a moment. Nice to have you with us, everyone. We're going to talk about some stuff that's very important that is not discussed in the mainstream media, not even on the left, and that's unfortunate. It should be. My guest is Dr. Mark Weisbrot. We're going to go to him in a moment. Let me just say that this morning when I was talking with Dr. Julian Whitaker, he says, Gary, did you remember when I gave away, I think it was 5,000 of your Drugging of Our Children documentaries? I said, yeah. He said, I'm going to give away 1,000 of your Autism Made in USA and Vaccine Nations at this conference. And I appreciated that because he's such a selfless individual that he would do that. And I appreciate it. That's how we share information. And he's one of the people in our movement, our progressive movement that shares information. So I thought, okay, let's do this. Let's help a lot of people in this audience who choose to be helped in giving two videos today that normally would be $80 for $19, $10 a piece. That's right at our cost. And what are the videos? You haven't seen them. One is called Rebalancing Your Life, and the other is called Enhancing Self-Esteem. And in Rebalancing Your Life, I show you all the ways that we get out of balance and how we compensate in negative ways and what that does to us and how we should be balancing our lives. If you balance your life, if you live in balance, you're not going to be processing disease, anger, hatred, jealousy, envy, insecurity. None of that can exist in a balanced life. But when you're living out of balance, all that does manifest. Similarly, so how to rebalance your life and what happens when you're out of balance, even if you're successful, and that's the trouble. A lot of people are very successful, have money, have everything they thought that was important, are still out of balance. And as a result, that ends up destroying their lives in different ways. The other documentary is Enhancing Self-Esteem. The trouble is our self-esteem is almost always enhanced by external stimulation and praise and reward. But that's the wrong approach. And boy, can that do a number on you. And I give a lot of examples of that, even subtle examples, starting with parents. So how can we change these tapes so we stop acting in childish, immature, and self-destructive ways, stop self-sabotaging our lives and relationships, and act in a positive way? We can establish a new sense of self-esteem. So in these two real fun lectures, you get those. Normally it's $80. It's $20 for both. So it's 10 bucks each. So you just saved $60, or you saved about 80%. Call 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. You can get one or both. One is $10. The other is $10. We've never offered them at this price. But I just thought today, since we gave Julian Whitaker all of those tapes to give out, I would send a gift out to the people who care about changing their lives and are willing to look at the truth within our society, what causes us to become so dysfunctional, so selfish, so disconnected from the world. Let's go to our guest standing by. Dr. Mark Weisbrot is co-director with Dean Baker, who has been a frequent guest on this program, of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C., specializing in domestic and international economic policy. And he writes weekly a column for The Guardian in the U.K. and is a frequent contributor to issues in the United States for the McClatchy News Service and Brazil's largest newspaper. He is also the president of the Just Foreign Policy, an independent nonprofit organization dedicated to reforming U.S. foreign policy based upon diplomacy, cooperation, international law. Nice to have you with us today, Mark.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Mark, let me give you the large question, and please take it and take your time and give us as an in-depth answer. Here is the larger issue, and I'll just paint it as broadly as possible. Right now, Greece and Spain, Ireland, to a lesser degree France, the United Kingdom, and Portugal are in trouble. They've been bailed out or given a lot of input by the International Monetary Fund that for the loans that will help stabilize their country's economic debt load and therefore be able to pay back some of the debt, they have to go through some structural adjustments. And those are different with each country, but they have to open up to more privatization. They have to reduce a lot of the public spending. So at the end of the day, a lot of average citizens are being adversely affected. They're being asked to make the sacrifice. On the other hand, people are asking, well, hold on a second. Why should we, the citizens, make the who are having to pay back the debts to the banks? Why can't the banks just write it off? And they're saying, oh, no, you can't do that. Well, now Iceland has done that, and Iceland is, we're told, is going to fall off the cliff financially. But then again, back in 2001, we said Brazil would fall off the Argentina would fall off the cliff and would be a pariah if it defaulted on its debts, and yet it did. Two-thirds of its debts were not forfeited, and they still, not only after a short period of decline, they actually thrived and turned around their economy, and means people were gainfully employed who otherwise wouldn't be. Tell us what you see now is the likely outcome if we do not make changes to help these countries, and why is it the UK, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, Russia, Canada, and the United States, the G8, why aren't they in agreement that we've got to get the euro zone reconfigured and help the average citizen, not just the banks? The forum is yours.
Well, Russia is not really, doesn't have much of a voice in the G8, so that's the G7 you're talking about, and that's run by the United States and its European allies. And those governments share a common view, which is the view primarily of the creditors in the world, and of course in Europe. And so, from a creditor's point of view, you just want to first of all punish these countries, Greece, Ireland, Spain, Portugal, because from their point of view they borrowed too much. Even though that's really not true. I mean, you could make the argument maybe in the case of Greece, but in the other countries, and even in Greece itself, I mean, they all really reached a state of fiscal insolvency or illiquidity from the financial collapse and the world recession of 2008 and 2009. So, you know, they didn't really overspend or overborrow. But the creditors don't look at that. They look at it from the, you know, if you're a big creditor and you're looking at it from that point of view, what you think is, well, if we give Greece a break, then Ireland and Portugal will want a break and Spain will want a break, and all of them are going to want to get out of this without punishment. So that's one thing they're doing. The other thing, that's one reason they look at it that way. The other reason, they're just also political opportunists. They have a conservative agenda, just like, you know, the Republicans in the United States, for example, or, you know, a good part of the Democrats, too. But part of this conservative agenda is to take advantage of the crisis to get the kind of change they want. So in Greece, they want, you know, 50 billion euros worth of privatizations, which not necessarily good for the country, but they're good for private interests. And they can force these upon Greece at a time when the country is, because of their policies, desperate for money. And so, and they're changing labor law and trying to, restructure these countries in a more conservative direction, again, just taking advantage of the crisis. So that's another part of it. And so that's how they see it. And, obviously they don't have to do this. There's an easy way out of this. For all these countries that have loans, only Greece and Ireland and Portugal have loans now from the IMF and the European authorities. So it's the IMF and the European authorities that are acting together, loaning the money and putting on the conditions. And I should say the European authorities are the dominant voice. The IMF is not really an independent institution in Europe. It's really the European and, you know, with the European authorities, European Commission, European Central Bank, in collaboration with the U.S. Treasury that really decides what to do about all of these countries. And so they're, you know, they have their agenda, and they're going to, they feel like they can just squeeze these countries indefinitely, even if it prolongs a recession and prolongs the high unemployment that you have, you know, 15% in Greece and Ireland, 20% in Spain, which is, again, under pressure from the same authorities, even though they haven't borrowed yet. But if they wanted to just help these countries, they could just give them, you know, low or zero interest loans, allow them to have the kind of fiscal stimulus policies that most of the world used to get out of the recession in 2009, and they could, you know, have the kind of monetary policies from the European Central Bank, like our Federal Reserve did here, right? Our Federal Reserve created $2 trillion already since the crisis started to make sure that this economy would not shrink unnecessarily. And they're pursuing a completely opposite approach in Europe.
Okay, if we're talking about helping countries, why don't you take us through what it actually means to be in Greece or Portugal or Ireland today, what it means when you are having to face an austerity program by the government and your life is going to be turned upside down because of it. Let's start with that.
Well, we don't have to imagine. We have something similar here for millions of people, right? We have 25 million people who are either unemployed, underemployed, or dropped out of the labor force altogether, and we have millions of people who have either had their homes foreclosed or are in that process. And so that's what it's like. The difference is that it's still getting worse there, whereas in the United States, it's getting better at a much too slow of a pace. But and it could, you know, we could fall back. But it's not the government. I mean, imagine that our government had responded, and we do in the state and local level, right? The state and local governments do cut back when there's a recession, and that makes things worse. But we had the federal government went in the opposite direction, and again, we had our Federal Reserve, our central bank, printing money to help stimulate the economy. So that's what it's like. It's like what, you know, millions and tens of millions of people are experiencing right here. Only a larger percentage of the population is experiencing that.
There's a big difference. Today in Spain, tens of thousands of people are in the streets. In other countries, they're actually protesting. The difference is, of those 25 million Americans, when was the last time you saw 25 Americans, let alone 25 million Americans, protesting?
Well, that's a very good point, and that is one big difference. That is what limits what the European authorities and those governments can do to punish the people of the Eurozone countries, all the countries. Well, to take an even more positive example, look at Germany. I mean, and this is just mostly from electoral pressure and from the power of their unions. But Germany did not do what it's trying to force on these poorer, you know, less fortunate European countries. They actually not only had a stimulus program, they did something even better, which we could do here. And that is they paid, the government subsidized employers to keep workers on during the recession and to not fire them, not lay them off, but to keep them. They reduced their hours some, but they did not reduce their pay anywhere near as much as they reduced their hours. So most of these workers got somewhat reduced hours, but not that much reduction in pay. And so they were mostly satisfied with that. And as a result, Germany ended up going through this recession and lost more output than we did here. So it was a serious recession, but their unemployment rate actually dropped from the beginning, the recession to afterwards, as opposed to ours, which practically doubled. And, of course, Spain's, which went up to 20%. So this is a rational policy, and it shows what can be done when, and this is a conservative government, too, but that was the pressure that they faced. And the other countries, yeah, there's also the pressure of people in the streets. The austerity in all of these countries would be a lot worse if it wasn't for that. And right now, the Greek government can't even agree on what to do because of the massive pressure in the streets. So that's a big difference, and you do need that kind of organization here. I think if we had it, we could probably get something like what the Germans did. There are, you know, from what I've heard here in Washington, President Obama was relatively was sympathetic to the idea of doing this job sharing, work sharing, and of course, you know, his advisors, some of whom were very close to Wall Street and other interests, didn't like it.
Well, I just believe that at this moment, if I were living in any of these countries and I saw my pension affected, I saw some of the public services affected, I would ask a simple question. If our banks, including the European banks, receive money from the Federal Reserve, $3.2 trillion, and we didn't know about this in 22,000 transactions, this was brought out under Freedom of Information Act from Bernie Sanders of Vermont, and they have not been held accountable as to why they gave money to hedge funds and corporations in America like Verizon and McDonald's at zero interest, 0.25 interest. And yet at no time have they made any effort to help stop the foreclosures and help Main Street. Then why should we any longer care about giving back all of the money that these bankers have been making at the cost of crippling our future? Your final thoughts.
Well, I think it's true that our government has... you know, even though compared to what they're doing in these in the Eurozone, some of the Eurozone countries, obviously, we at least had a stimulus, and we at least had the Federal Reserve going in the right direction. It's still way too little compared to what is very easily feasible. I mean, our whole stimulus here, if you count the federal and the state and local governments, which go in the opposite direction, it was about not even one-eighth the size of what was needed just to make up for the fall-off in demand that you had from the bursting of the real estate bubble. So they just didn't do their job, and that's why you had such a deep recession and you're having such a sluggish recovery. Most importantly, a sluggish recovery in employment and income. And so that's the problem that we have. We don't have accountability. We don't have officials that are accountable to the electorate. And I have to say also, you know, the media is a big part of this because the media sets the framework for what the politicians do. And this is especially the case in terms of President Obama. I mean, he looks to the media as his number one constituency and makes most of his decisions based on what the media is going to think of it and whether they'll like him for it or not. And because the media accepts this and really doesn't present a lot of criticism from a progressive point of view, but does present a lot from a right-wing point of view that the government should do even worse things, I think that's part of the reason we end up with where we are right now.
I would agree with that. Thank you very much. I appreciate you coming on, Dr. Mark Weisbrot, and sharing your insights with us. I'm Gary Nolan. I want to thank everyone for having joined us today. We're out of time. Have a wonderful afternoon. Blue skies, blue boy.
Gary Null Show is produced in our New York City studio. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matt Bogart. All shows are archived by Joe Kemp. The chief archivist is Sharon Pride, and the program director is Jason Taubenfeld. Wasted on the oceans and upon our seas.